All right, so this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Hewitt, that's H-U-O-T, recorded on UVic campus on 4 March 2011, interviewed by Cameron McKeegan. And Lieutenant Colonel, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Absolutely.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, I suppose we should just start with the basics. Where are you from?
Born in Manitoba, St. Boniface, and lived just about everywhere in Canada.
Right on.
And for about the past 35 years, I've been offshore.
Offshore, okay. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, two brothers, deceased, and a sister.
And what were your parents' professions?
Well, my father was with the Canadian National Railways. Then he was an expediter on the Alaska Highway when they built that. And then from there, they went up and built another railroad from Seven Islands to a place called Knob Lake, which is, I think, today called Schefferville out in Labrador. So I grew up in that kind of northern Ontario, northern Quebec environment. And my mother, of course, was a housewife.
I see. So is there any history of military in your family? Has anybody else served?
During the war, I had cousins that had served. And career officers within our family, no, I'm the first one.
Okay, and so what made you join the Royal Canadian Air Force?
Well, I was at the University of New Brunswick at the time. Of course, I've always lived around airplanes. When you live up in northern Quebec and northern Manitoba, you know, that's the main method of transportation. And so I've always had an interest in flying, but it was a curiosity more than a passion. But when I went to the University of New Brunswick, I was introduced to the University Reserve Training Plan, which is a URTP, was referred to at that time, as compared to the ROTP, Regular Officer Training Plan. And the difference is that one is voluntary and the other one is obligatory. Obligatory in the sense that you have to give so many years of service back for what they've done for you. And I had the opportunity to apply for air crew as a URTP at UNB, and decided to give it a shot. There was no obligation. And much to my surprise, I was accepted. Mm-hmm. And ended up training in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan for the summer. That gave me a bit of a problem in the sense that I always worked up north to have enough money to be able to pay for my university tuition and whatnot. But I spent one summer making $45 a month. Mm-hmm. And that made the economics very difficult. So I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. But then an opportunity presented itself in Moose Jaw.
What year was this?
This is
1954.
Okay. And in 1952, they opened up the Military College in Saint-Jean. And they were looking for persons that would be interested in getting a university education within that military college. But in particular, they were looking for Air Force people. And I had already passed the difficult part, which was being selected for air crew. And so I applied and was accepted at CMR. And that was in 54, so I went there at the end. So it was very lucky for me, actually, quite frankly, because I didn't have enough money to go back to university, and they picked up the tab and they said, here, we'll dress you, we'll house you. And I loved it. It was just great. Best decision I ever made in my life.
Excellent. Can you describe the perception of the your perception, of course, of the political climate at the time you joined up with regards to the Soviet Union.
Well, our big concern, of course, in the early 50s was the back end of Korea. The Korean conflict was very fresh in our minds. Quite frankly, I think that by 1954 was still fresh, and the USSR situation was developing. And quite frankly, I was too young, I think, to really understand the political side of it. But that quickly changed as we moved into the latter 50s and to becoming quite a serious focus of everything that we did.
Okay. Well, we'll revisit that because that will be a big chunk. Can you describe, this is all your perception, mm-hmm. of Canadian relations with the United States at the time you joined up?
Again, I think it's when you're a young flying officer, or a young cadet, it's pretty difficult to be able to put your finger on those relationships. From my perspective, it certainly didn't. It wasn't an issue. In fact, in the flying game, particularly when I got to Europe, flying over there, it was more camaraderie than any sort of we didn't see anything political in it at all. As far as we're concerned, we're all doing the same job, and we're all in the business of trying to get behind him and shoot him down. And we would practice, and we would fly day by day, and that was the fun. And when we got film footage of them, we turned around and brought it over to their mess, showed them the film footage, showed them how badly they flew, and then we'd all get drunk.
Perfect. All right, well, my next question is, did you serve overseas? And you said that you have, but
yes.
But where and for how long?
I was fortunate enough to be assigned to F-86s. They were, at that point, in 1958, they must have been starting to think of the phasing out of the Sabres out of Europe and towards a different role. So they weren't assigning that many people to F-86s. They were putting a lot of them onto CF-100s and or transport. But I was fortunate enough to get the F-86 posting, and it was sent to two fighter wing in France. Grostenquin was the name of the place.
And could you spell that for me?
Grostenquin. Two fighter wing is what it was. We had four fighter wings in Air Division.
Excellent.
And there was one other organization. It was called METS, and that was Air Division Headquarters. So we had two wings in France and two wings in Germany. And so I was assigned there. I arrived there in the summer of 1954. What am I saying? I'm sorry, 1958. And left in 1962, in September of 1962. So I was there about 4 years, both on the squadron and in wing headquarters, so in ops.
What were your primary responsibilities while you were overseas?
Well, as a young flying officer and you get overseas, my primary responsibility was to, you start at the bottom, you're a wingman, and air fighting was the name of the game. And so you have to develop the skills and the experience of mixing it up with other people and covering your wingman, your lead. And eventually, through the squadron, you'd move up to what we call an element lead, which is responsible for two aircraft, and then you'd be a section lead, which you'd be responsible for four. And we would always fly generally into active action, if you want to call it that. That's a poor word for it, but we would always go four aircraft at a time, two elements of two. Our role was to intercept under with radar control, and to get behind the other guy and get the film footage and the rest of it. We were on a high state of readiness as we started in 1958, and you can imagine by 1960, with the Cuban crisis and everything else, we were on a very, very high state of alert, to the point where we were actually not leaving the base. We were on the base, we were staying on the base, and we were on 5 or 15 minute alert.
Wow.
So, yeah, the name of the game was to be very good at what you do in air fighting, and also that meant that your gunnery skills had to be very good, and we would do that. And we started off in North Africa, because you can't shoot live rounds over Europe, but we would use live ammunition. And so we started off in Rabat, Morocco, and then we moved to Decimomano, Sardinia, when we helped the Italians open up that base, which is now still operating today. It still is a gunnery base. So the exercise was all about air-to-air fighting, and Canadians were particularly good at it.
Is that right?
And to the point where, as other countries started to phase out of the fighter role per se, because we went through a phase where we figured everything would be bombs. So we came out of the fighter role, went into the sort of the bomber role, and now we've gone back into that fighter interceptor role. I think the Israelis showed us a thing or two. But we were really, I guess we stopped rotating people, and we let people serve out their time overseas because of getting ready for the F-104 changeover. Mm-hmm. What would happen is that most people would only get a 1 year posting in this position, an F-86. Guys like myself got 4 years. So we knew our airplane really well. So air fighting became second nature to us. What happened, though, is that because we were really anxious to mix it up with other aircraft, other countries started to tell, in fact, other countries banned their aircraft from fighting with us.
Really? Just because you guys would make them look so bad?
Well, and not only that, but some of those aircraft weren't really designed to do this, but they'd want to mix it up anyway.
Oh.
A Voodoo is a perfect example, the F-101. Mm-hmm. If they got into a high angle of attack, that aircraft would pitch up, and the only way out is, well, most of the time the guy has to bail out. So he loses the aircraft. So, you know, I mean, the Americans love to mix it up with us, particularly they were in Vietnam. And, you know, they were rotated back to Europe as part of their tours, so they wanted to mix it up with their F-4s. But we ended up having to just fight with ourselves. Now, you can imagine there were eight squadrons of about 20 plus pilots each, and we just go up looking for each other. The result was that the air fights got more intense, more dangerous, actually, and we started having mid-air collisions. So that's how bad some of those got. So after about the third or fourth, around 1962 or so, they turned around and they said, "Listen, you guys, you know, cool it. That's enough practice as if you're flying an F-104. So we started doing low-level tactical roles with an airplane that was really a day fighter. But Canada played an extremely important role over there. We were very significant in our presence. Everybody knew we were there. And everything from trophy shoots, like the Guggenmeyer Trophy, which was a gunnery competition between all NATO countries, and we used to walk away with that. Mm. And It was a little bit unfair, sort of on the side. We were shooting rounds that were, the caliber were, I think they were about half inch. The Americans were firing 20 millimeter cannons. So the name of the game was you count the holes. You know, so they would drag a flag behind another aircraft, and we'd use colored paint on the ammunition. Mm-hmm. So you just count, who scored what. Well, it was easy to count ours, but with theirs, they come back with a flag in tatters because they were putting, 20 millimeter cannon shells through the same hole. So, but it was a lot of fun. I say fun because we really, truly, in the end, we never did fire a shot in anger. We did live intercepts. We had any aircraft that would turn around and wander outside of the corridor into Berlin, for example. We would be scrambled and intercepted and identify the aircraft, and then we're under Canadian and American control. So, but we made our presence felt. I can assure you of that.
Excellent. So you said there were some live intercepts there. You did come into contact with Soviet aircraft?
I did. Wow. In one section. It was a Russian crate, which was something like your DC-3. But he had not filed a flight plan, and he had wandered outside of the corridor. And we were sent in to intercept them, and we did. But you have little practical things that happen to you which you're never trained for. And one of those was that we had never been taught the Russian alphabet.
Oh, the Serbian alphabet.
So, which is very different. So when you turn around and they say, tell us what is the identification of this aircraft, and you look at it and you see hieroglyphics that may as well have been out of the Stone Age, because you really don't recognize what it is. And so I know in my particular case, I had to get rather close to be able to copy those letters onto my knee with a grease pencil so that I could come back and show them what it was that I saw. We didn't have cell phones and cameras, So it was in and out of the clouds and trying to do this. Unfortunately, I guess I got a little too close because there was an official complaint filed by themselves, and which we ignored.
Yeah, of course. All right. Well, I'm glad you touched on that our contribution over there was significant.
Very.
Because my next question is, what do you believe were the significant factors of what did the RCAF do over there that made them stand out, aside, of course, from being excellent pilots?
Our presence, the size of our presence. We had army there as well. We had boots on the ground in Germany. But the presence of four fighter wings and 12 squadrons that gave 24-hour-a-day coverage, because the CF-100 was a night fighter, effectively a night interceptor, with a radar interceptor. We were fair weather guys, When we couldn't fly, they were flying. But it was one of the largest presence in Europe. The Americans had Bitburg and Ramstein as air bases. And they had Toulouse in France. So they were there, certainly. But I think that even the RAF, for example, only had one or two bases. We had four. So it was a huge presence, and it was a very significant contribution. Whenever there was an alert, whenever there was a necessity for people to be on standby, which we called Zulu, we were there, and we were always there. And we had our own radar and our own radar controllers. And our own radar controllers tended to be pilots who were our guys that had flown intercepts and then went down and controlled it. So they knew exactly what was going on. So no, Canada was there. It wasn't a show. It was reality, and it was significant.
Is there any one factor in your perception, of course, that that you believe greatly helped that contribution? Like, was it the government that wanted to do it, or was it pressure put on the RCAF or by the RCAF?
I think it was a follow-up of the Second World War. I mean, Canada had a massive presence in the Second World War for a country of our population. And, you know, 1954-55, that was only 9 or 10 years after the war. So we had a massive merchant navy. We had Air Force wings in the UK. We had, you know, a huge presence. And I think it was just a continuation of that commitment to NATO, that, you know, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. You know, Canada was obviously a founding member. So I think it was a continuation of that. And the eventual decline and withdrawal is probably financial. I mean, you know, Canadians are not... they're not military-minded, and when necessary, everybody comes up. And in peacetime, everybody says, why do we need them? So something's got to happen for everybody to get motivated. But in this case, everybody was motivated. Remember, we had the Second World War, we had Korea, you know, Americans were involved, Vietnam. So it was very much a concern and a priority for Canada to have this.
I see. All right. Is there any particular factor you can think of that might have hindered Canada's participation in NATO?
In those years?
In those years and following. Like you said, financial probably brought up the decline. Is that the only factor? Or?
I think so. You know, I don't think it's a lack of commitment. From ourselves. Politically, within Canada, I couldn't tell you if there's a lack of support. But I mean, if they cut back on the budget, there's got to be a lack of political will or interest in Canada to continue to fund this kind of thing. And then, of course, there's the massive change in way of thinking. We're spending too much on defense. We should be spending on Medicare. And other things, which, you know, can't find fault with that, but there was quite a different way of thinking that happened, you know, from that, the CFM Fort to Beaumarks or whatever it happens to be. But my feeling is my experience in Europe and what we were trying to accomplish as far as letting the other side know that we were there and we were ready if they had any ideas to come and visit. If we'd had another aircraft platform, even without firepower or radar or anything else, like the CF-5, the 105, the Arrow, if we'd had that aircraft just to fly up and down the border at Mach 2 when everybody else was doing 0.89, or, you know, that would have blown their socks off. And it would have been absolutely fantastic. That's all we wanted. We just wanted that kind of a device, just to be higher and faster and let them know that we're serious about this whole thing. That didn't happen. We went the other way. Yeah. We went close to the ground and F-104s.
Yeah. So an interceptor to match the skill of the guys who'd be flying it, I suppose.
Well, it would have been another generation for sure, but Canadians have always made great pods. I don't know what it is, but it's probably our environment up here that we have to fly in conditions that are quite a bit worse than most people.
And the size of the country, too. We have to fly to get from one place to the other.
Aviation is like Australia. You know, aviation is part of the game. Mm-hmm.
All right. So you finished up in September 1962.
That's correct.
In Europe, and then you came back to North America.
Came back to North America. Went back to university for a year, and then on a cooperative engineering program with the University of Waterloo and a company called CAE, which specializes in flight simulators. and in an engineering capacity went over to CAE, and I worked with them, and I flew with them as a test. Actually, I worked with them again in a technical capacity, but they preferred to have me sitting in the cockpit doing test flights on all kinds of new aircraft. And I was doing that for a little while, and then the opportunity came to go to Italy on the F-104 program. And in support, it was our flight simulators at CAE on Italian, German bases all over Europe, because as part of the NATO offsetting of costs, we had our squadrons overseas, and in turn they would place contracts with Canadian firms for military equipment if they could, and flight simulators was a lovely choice. So I spent 5 years in Italy, actually, working with a fighter squadron in northern Italy, and that was very interesting. Their role was very different, of course. It was a low-level tactical, and they were nuclear. So, Canada was not, but... So I did that, and when I returned to Canada, that's when I joined the Air Reserves in Montreal. So I went back to CAE, continued with CAE in the flight simulator game on the marketing side, this time for 747s and various commercial and military aircraft. Mm-hmm. But the Air Reserves allowed me to maintain my flying skills and my love of the military and the Air Force. I mean, it was just great. And I must say that the Air Reserves was a real eye-opener for me. All of the people within that organization volunteer their time. They certainly don't do it for the money. the pay was just a fraction of what regular people would get, but they would come out on weekends and on evenings in Montreal. We flew out of St. Hubert. And these fellows were... Most of them were commercial, almost all of them on the flying side were commercial pilots with Air Canada, with Nordair at the time. And I was one of the few that actually had a non-flying responsibility and still was flying with the Air Reserves. So for me, it was good because it kept my hand in and it opened up my eyes to another activity that I didn't realize that the military was involved in.
We'll come back to that, but you raised an interesting point. I'd like to when your time in Italy, you helped the Italian Air Force essentially prepare for tactical nuclear warfare essentially. Is your experience was that widely practiced in the RCAF? Did a lot of people in your position go over and help other air forces in their training, even if they weren't actively flying?
Most of them remained in the flying game. So in other words, they either went commercial as they came out, because we had a huge reduction, the 500 they call them, because when they turned around and phased out the F-86s, we had a lot of surplus pilots. Mm-hmm. And these pilots... Most of them tried to go into the commercial aviation, but some of them went military to other countries. And one country in particular, in the Middle East, they were very sought after. And actually, because of their air fighting experience, and of course I'm talking about Israel. Mm-hmm. And several of our pilots went down there and were actually in the Israeli Air Force for quite a while. But most of them went commercial.
Okay.
And because the military had no room for them, and then there's not, there's only one Air Force in Canada.
Yeah.
And an Air Force military career is pretty structured. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that you step into halfway. You know, you're not a middle-aged person and you step into it, or you have so much experience. you sort of start from the ground up and work your way up.
Sure.
And then from there you go into other activities. So there's a lot of pilots today, well, today, certainly then, in the commercial, flying commercially, were all ex-military pilots.
Yeah, no, I was just wondering if Canada's contribution to NATO, when once the fighters were withdrawn, increased towards helping other air forces. But
no, not officially, for sure. I don't think that was part of the role or seen as part of the role. And in my particular case, it just worked out that way. And my participation was not so much to teach those guys how to do anything. It was more to maintain that equipment so they were able to do it. And, you know, today that laptop of yours would probably has enough memory and is fast enough to be able to drive an entire flight simulator. In those days, they were analog machines.
Oh.
It took five rooms of servos and pots and things like this, to which was a building onto its own, just to do elementary mathematical calculations. So it was a big step for us to go from there to digital. But these particular machines for the F-104 had radar plates on them, which were satellite images. Satellite images, were satellite images, they were actually flyovers where they got reflectivity off the various ground situations, and then they would recreate these on plates so that when you're flying the aircraft, you could actually see where you were going. In other words, your radar, all you had was a radar picture, but your returns on the radar were very close to what you would get if you actually went to these places. It's the only way they could do it.
Wow.
So they would come in with their little black box, and they would practice the run that they would actually have to do if the balloon went up.
All right. Yeah, that was kind of an aside.
Sure.
It sparked my interest. Okay, back to the reserves, I suppose some of the big issues I'd like to discuss. You were actually in Europe for the cancellation of the CF-105 and the Bullmark missiles and the acquisition of F-101s. But I suppose to start off with a general question, how did the formation of NORAD affect you while you were flying for the reserves?
Well, my time in the reserves was about 69 to 79, about 10 years.
Okay.
NORAD was established, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We had in the Air Reserves nothing to do. Again, John would know more about that. But our role was mainly tactical support for ground troops. In other words, we go to Camp Gagetown, we pick up paratroopers, we bring them up to, 8,000 feet, and they'd all jump out. Mm. We do message pickups. In other words, we drag something behind the aircraft, and they get two poles and a string in between, and we could pick things up, like you see in the James Bond movie. It was just wonderful. We flew the single engine Otter. Before my time, they had Vampires and jets of that thing. But in my period, we flew Otters on skis, on floats. It was a wonderful aircraft because it had a lot of range, and you could put it down almost on a postage stamp. It was perfect for the type of stuff we did. We did search and rescue. Tax support in various forms, and we had two squadrons in Montreal. I don't know how many there were in Toronto, but we sort of had Edmonton, Toronto, Montreal, and the bigger cities. One of the problems we had, of course, is finding the personnel to be able to do this, because you had to be ex-military. You had to be trained by the military to be able, first of all, to wear the uniform, take the rank, take the responsibility. And so a lot of the commercial pilots that were ex-military were gravitated here willingly. It was a different sort of flying. But trying to keep these people was a real challenge. And I found that when I finally became CO of the squadron I was in, which was 401 squadron, and that was my biggest challenge. My biggest challenge was to keep the manning levels up and keep the training up, and that and to keep training going in light of very restricted budgets.
Did Canada's a better question would be, what was your personal opinion towards Canada's nuclear policy at the time?
My personal opinion?
Yeah, and perhaps expand it to, you know, that of the general opinion that you experienced, but.
Well, my personal opinion is that if you look at France and you look at the UK and you look at the United States and you see the people that are sitting around the table making decisions in this world are all member of the nuclear club. We're not. And that's our position today. Our position is that Canada is not particularly significant. I hate to say it, but a strong military earns you a seat at the table. I mean, our participation in the Second World War got us a seat where normally we would never have a seat. So, I mean, a lot of people disagree, and they're surely, you know, they have a point. Should we have nuclear weapons? No, nobody should have nuclear weapons, but they do. Yeah. So, is our position, I guess we'll rely on somebody else to look after us, or we're going to look after ourselves. So, you know, we had the opportunity to do it. We certainly had the technology to do it. I mean, Chalk River was a developing spot for a lot of this. But there you go. I think from a military perspective, nuclear capability would have been would have given us a different voice at the table for sure.
Among the people you talked to at the time, was there a lot of support for the nuclear? Like, did a lot of people believe we should go nuclear?
I don't think the subject ever came up with me. Again, I spent a lot of time offshore,
right?
And out there, it's it would never raise. But you asked a personal opinion, and I've given you a retroactive one. At the time, I don't care. It was that big an issue.
Of course, yeah. No, hindsight is 20/20. Okay. So. And, you know, at this time, Canada was in two alliances, NATO and NORAD. How did that affect the reserves, the pressure of being in two alliances?
I'm not sure I could answer that one, mainly because I think the reserves, we never felt anything from a NORAD or NATO perspective, because I think we're looked at more as a support group for the boots on the ground.
Okay.
Again, bringing people in and out, bringing supplies in and out, reaching places in Canada. I mean, really, that aircraft and what we're flying was designed for Canada, not international. We have to get into lakes and dirt strips and places like that, you know. And you could turn around and say, well, a helicopter can do it. Well, yes, but a helicopter after 150 miles, you got to land somewhere to pump some more gas in, and we'd go 600. Mm-hmm. And we'd fly all day. But so it was really support, and all of our activities were really aimed at Canada, domestic. And all of that changed, of course, when they changed the aircraft type from Otters to Kiowas, to helicopters. And other people will be able to give you a lot more insight as to what led to that decision and what they figured our role would be, because that's when I decided not to make the transition to helicopters because it happened on my watch, mainly because I only had about another 3 or 4 months left because the term of a CEO is limited to 2 years. And I just couldn't see them spending $500,000 to train me on a helicopter then to go back and do something else. And it was a waste of money, and I said, give it to somebody else.
Can you think of any examples where the increase in budget cuts that the reserves faced, can you think of any examples where you had to kind of make do with what you had, sort of thing?
Every day. Every flying hour. The way you finally managed to get around it, well, I didn't get around it, but we had to defend our budget, defend our flying time. It was, you could feel the pressure coming from the regular forces wanting to get their hands on the budget. If they could possibly have the budget that was being used for the air reserves. Because again, you see, the air reserve, we were flying Otters. Our pilots, you couldn't easily move them across and put them on, I suppose you could put them on a Herc, because most of them flew multi-engine aircraft for like Air Canada. But their availability is somewhat restricted. You'd have to sort of increase our level of alert in Canada to activate an air reserve unit and then retrain everybody on something else. So from their perspective, they could probably see, that money could be better used somewhere else. But from an air reserve perspective, because there's a lot of history, particularly the squadron I was with the 401, which was the only squadron that flew in the Battle of Britain.
Oh, wow.
It was number one squadron. And, you're talking about guys like David Bolson and Frank McGill, and, they're the guys that, were involved with these things. And, and then maintaining these skills, these aircraft maintenance skills, and is very important, particularly when they're people that have everyday jobs. So you can activate these people very quickly. Turn around and say, we're gone from this state of emergency to this state of emergency. The air reserves and all reserve units are very easily, you just move them up a notch. Whereas if you take a civilian, you can't do it. You could do almost instantaneously when you have an existing reserve unit. So for us, it was very important to maintain this capability and to be able to move these people and put them right into the line of fire. But when the regular forces were under so much pressure for the budget, that there's no doubt that they looked at us rather lustfully and figured out how they could turn around and do it. And then there was a cutback in the flying hours. So what I did is one of our officers was very, very good at statistics and maintaining statistics and records, and he started to track everything that we did very carefully, and he plotted, and we managed with his help to operate within these constraining parameters and still get in our flying time and still get in our meter tack eval requirements and our proficiency requirements. And it was wonderful, because in the end, when they came back and tried to make an argument to make changes, we were able to lay out all of the numbers on the table and say, here's where it is, and where are your numbers? And they weren't there.
Excellent.
So it was definitely a struggle. It was a challenge. And we had to fight very hard to maintain the whole concept of reserves, particularly of air reserves, and to protect those assets. And that, I think, was the biggest challenge. Whereas in Europe, the biggest challenge was to maintain your proficiency to be able to be ready to go into battle at a moment's notice. Mm-hmm. In Canada, the challenge was to continue to exist. It's interesting to see that today, in places like Afghanistan, that reserves play an important role. So the military is able to draw upon people like yourself, if you had a military training, and turn around and say, we have these assets available at a very cost effective way. I have to take my hat off to the reserves. I've served 10 years in the regular forces and 10 years in the reserves, and I love them both dearly, but I admire the people in the Air Reserves for giving up their family time at great sacrifice sometimes, and doing this and not doing it for money. I mean, the whatever was paid, not only was it taxed on top of your civilian income, but it barely covered whatever cost that you had, but people didn't do it for that.
I know I asked this a little bit earlier, but I'd like to go deeper into it. So while you were in the reserves, flying the Otter, what were your primary responsibilities? Like you specifically, or your squadron?
Well, the squadron had a range of tactical support. It sort of went over it a little bit earlier, but everything like to support the boots on the ground, be it in communication, be it in supplies, being it to carry paratroopers, and also to access areas that was very difficult to access. We would go to the Arctic from Montreal. And fly out of Baffin Island, on the northern part of Baffin Islands in Nanisivik, and we also went in there with floats. I know that I was on one exercise, which is in support of the Franklin expedition. For example, we had Navy divers on board, and we would land the aircraft in the Arctic Ocean, soft floes around. I mean, little sea ice, which is nothing too serious. But the boys were diving off the end of the float and going down and doing this sort of stuff. So it was really a support role. It wasn't an attack role, which sort of blended with the type of aircraft that we had. My personal responsibility, I started off at the bottom of the pile as a flying officer, which is great joy. Your only job in life is to fly and to do it right, which is absolutely marvelous. With promotion comes changes of responsibility.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, eventually, I over the years, I became the commanding officer of 401, and that's when I began to realize that I had to get my priorities straight, and which was to keep the squadron going, keep it manned, keep it trained. And it's very different. It's a different sort of responsibility. We all go into flying because we love to fly, but when we get into these administrative positions, the picture changes. And the biggest challenge, I think, in that period of time, which I'm talking about, I guess from 69 to 79, particularly as we approached 78, 79, was budgetary restraints.
And this is after integration now?
Yes.
There's a great question. How did integration affect the reserves?
I can't say it had a major impact on the reserves. I think it had a major impact on the regular force, because the Air Force was blue, the Navy, they were, again, going back to the 50s, we were a big family, completely self-supporting, with hospitals and schools and homes, PMQs and our messes, everything. I mean, we'd be in France, we're like a little Canada in the middle of this different country. So there's strong bonds between people, and Canada's military is not so big that you don't turn around, you're posted somewhere and then you're posted somewhere else. You tend to meet the same people again. So you know everybody eventually. So it was Integration didn't impact the reserves that much, but it certainly, I think, impacted the regular forces. Now, in my particular case, I came out of the military college system, and the military college system is an integrated system. I mean, whether you're your Army, Navy, or Air Force, you all wore the same uniform and you looked the same, so it wasn't that big of a deal. But from a morale point of view, you know, particularly when they would transfer people that were air trained into another completely different environment, I mean, the Navy into the Army or the Army into the Air Force, and I think it had a morale impact for sure. And I think, again, anytime you're team building, you want to have a team spirit. You want to have, you know, you have team colors, you have team uniforms, you have, you know, it's the name of the game is you form a team. If you want to turn around and have a really good NHL team, you don't turn around and take an orange sweater that nobody has. It's one thing if it's Team Canada, but this wasn't Team Canada. And yeah, it certainly had an impact on morale, but I don't think it affected their proficiency as to what they did. But I think it impacted their morale, their well-being, and their concerns. Right. It's very important in the military to feel as if you belong part of a family and that you're being supported, and that you can always rely on them. And in the flying game, particularly again, when you get into this air fighting stuff, you rely on your buddy. You know, we would go in through the soup in France and come down to a 200-foot ceiling with an aircraft that was never intended to do that, four of us at a time. And you relied on the guy that was leading us. And if he made a mistake, you all had a very serious problem. So you just trusted him completely. And that's why the mess life was so good. And, you know, it was again, a team thing. If you don't trust your leader, if you don't trust the man that's you know, that you're following, you got a problem.
Right. And so you're suggesting integration, perhaps?
I think for team building, it was difficult. I think you need a strong team, and you need a team spirit. And the team has to rely on their leader. And they have to know that their leader is going to support them,
right,
and be with them, and that the entire organization is going to be with you and is going to support you. And I must say that when you read today of people who come back from Afghanistan and missing limbs and having to struggle, is disheartening.
So there was kind of a... Instead of being your own separate family, you were now just part of a
hodgepodge.
A hodgepodge. Okay. Excellent. Going back to the support roles of the reserves,
right.
That sounded, especially up in the Arctic, I have a particular soft spot for the Arctic. So you would... very, very rarely would it be of a military nature, like an offensive nature, you said. But what kind of operations would you support the boots on the ground?
How about, for example, one of the roles that we had was photography, was aerial photography. So we would go to the Arctic and support the mapping of the Arctic. And on one case, as a result of this, they would put cairns on the ground and we would go over and we would photograph these things, and they had the actual coordinates of this thing and was compared to where the photograph was. And they moved an island almost a kilometer. That's how we, you know, we didn't have, you know, our cartographers at the time were going back a ways. But so it played an important role in supporting mapping, for example. We would get a request for tasking from Ottawa. And it could be something like the cartographers who would turn around and say, listen, we're up there this summer, up in northern Baffin Island, and we need aerial support. Helicopters, how do you get a helicopter up there? You got to put it in the back end of a Herc or something and fly it up, but we could fly up. So we would be tasked on several occasions to go up into the Arctic and to support them with film and camera. So we would work together with them, and we would run up and down Baffin Island, and fascinating place, actually, and do this kind of work. Another task was, again, on the Franklin expedition is another example, where that was part of Canada's centennial project, I think it was at the time. To see if they could find this at all. And so we took the Navy in there, Navy divers, landed in the water and went to these places they wanted to go, and they went paddling around underneath, you know, jumping off the float. I got to tell you, I admire those guys, because they come up out of the, from being underneath, and they'd have ice on the beards. So, you know, I mean, I felt very comfortable in the cockpit of the aircraft where they were. No, but our job was to get them in safely and get them out safely. And you know, there's probably dozens and dozens. Again, John was involved more on that side than myself. I would respond to the task. I wasn't responsible for tasking. That's a different role altogether. Mm-hmm.
The Twin Otter. Did you ever fly one of those?
No, I haven't, and I wish I had.
Oh, I see. The only reason I asked, my grandfather worked for de Havilland, and he built them.
Did he? Yes. That's a fantastic. It brings up an interesting point. Our preference was not Kiowas. We didn't want Kiowas. We wanted a turbo otter. That would have been the machine. They're flying here all the time right now. Mm-hmm. Now, that would have given us the range, it would have given us the endurance, it would have modernized. See, the problem we had with the piston-driven otter was that we're running out of parts. It's very, very hard on a 600-horsepower engine. The cylinder head pressure, you had to be monitoring all the time. You're actually, you'd fly that aircraft, it's just like the jet, you'd fly it by keeping an eye on your tailpipe temperature. Well, on this one, you're flying it by keeping an eye on your on your cylinder head pressure. And because if you blew a gasket or a ring, it was expensive and difficult. You'd have oil all over the place, and it was difficult to replace. But if we could have re-engined that thing the way they did with a turbo, we'd still be flying it today, and it would have had. Well, you saw how these things fly around here. I mean, I think that would have been a perfect role for the reserves, and to keep those squadrons flying and just change the aircraft. But I guess the re-engining and the changes required to do that was, well, I don't know if it was any more expensive than the Kiowa. But I can see from the regular forces, it was more useful to have a pilot that was trained on helicopters than they could on a helicopter that they were flying in the regular forces, so that you could turn around and pick them up and drop them into the regular force to do the same job. But from my little perspective, I must say that keeping the identity of the reserve units separate and having them with a specific role and task to do is a wonderful way to support.
But so at this time, at least it seems like the regular forces were given, obviously they're given more of a budget, but they're also given priority for.
Well, definitely. I think we're in a support role. I mean, we were not the sharp end of the stick. We were a resource that was a voluntary resource, which people gave up their time and said, we're available if you need us. That's what the reserves are all about. And we don't make the call as to what that requirement's going to be. That they do. They have the big picture, no doubt about it. From a narrower perspective, to keep these units together and to keep their support together makes it easy to activate the squadron as a unit and to transfer it as a unit. So you've got everything together. You've got the maintenance, the logistics, everything that you need is together as a unit, rather than just split it up and say, you're going here, you're going there, you're going there, and everybody's, you know, it's gone. It's not, but I'm not an expert on modern warfare.
Yeah, fair enough. I believe you've kind of half answered this already, but be good in the direct question. So, what in your opinion, was the major hindrance of towards the RCAF Reserve? What stopped them from being as effective as they could be?
You mean then? Now?
Yesterday? Then. Or were they as effective as they could be?
Well, you know, if the RCAF is a sort of organization, if you gave them the right equipment, they're going to deliver. But you got to give them the right stuff, and if you saddle them with something that doesn't work, Sea Kings and that kind of stuff. You can't expect them to perform miracles. They perform miracles, all right. They keep something flying that shouldn't be. And, you know, something that says we have an operational life of 10 years, the next thing you know, it's 15, then it's 20, then it's 25 years, and they keep this thing going. I mean, I hate to say it, but I don't think it's not a lack of will. It's not a lack of skill. It's a lack of money. And in Canada, priorities are not the military. Priorities are set politically, and politics and military are not happy friends. So it's Canada certainly has proven itself again and again that it is quite capable of holding its own and doing it extremely well. But it needs the tools. It's got the people. It's got the personnel, it's got the skills, it's got the education, the training, all those things are there, all those elements are there, but you can't turn around and give them a spade and say, you know, do the work of a bulldozer. It's not going to work. But, it's very difficult to turn around and fault anybody because our priorities have changed. And Canada has decided we were going to be non-nuclear, which is fair enough. And it's decided that it's not going to be a leading military power in Canada, or in Canada and the world. And that it's going to accept a support role for NATO. And that's pretty well what we've been doing, I think. And I don't think that's changed a lot. I'm sure there must be an awful lot of soul searching sometimes when we get involved with in places like Bosnia and other places where European countries are not there, and we are. So that causes a lot of tough soul searching. Afghanistan, European countries have got a lot of them have got better positions than we do. We're on the firing line. So we want to be non-aggressive militarily, for example. We don't like to be the pointy end of the stick where we're doing the shooting, but we seem to end up there. We're great people that our armed forces are great at training, but that's not what we're doing, and we're not prepared for it, and we don't have the manpower to do it.
Right.
We just don't have the manpower. So, it boils down to the big picture is it's political will and it's political decision, and Canadians are the ones that vote. They're the ones that elect, and the politicians want to be re-elected. So those of us that believe the military is necessary for our own sovereignty, we're there. But obviously we're going to respect the will of those who aren't. But a lot of Canadians, I'm sure, are, certainly my generation anyway.
And, you kind of were phrasing that in present tense. Is that what you believe the reason to be for the huge downscale in the RCAF and the reserves?
I think so.
Okay. Excellent. Just
That and the fact that they had other issues coming up that was more popular. You get more votes with Medicare than you do with buying a new aircraft. I mean, Now, you know, an interesting, it's a bit of an aside, but, and I'm sure it's been discussed a lot in other places, but it would be fascinating to know what really led to the decision to not go ahead with the 105. You know, was it really financial? When you've got something that's better than anybody else has got, and we end up buying Bullmarks.
Yeah. which are not useful unless they're equipped with nuclear warheads, which Canada is not prepared to. Yeah.
I mean, you know, in retrospect, but at the time, you know, it's sometimes very difficult to see what's, you know, through the wheat and the chaff and the smoke and the mirrors and everything else is what the heck is really going on. But our perspective is to serve in the military and to do it the best of our ability. And I think that's true today. I don't think there's any, you know, there's no reason why everybody doesn't have his heart in it. And I think the only thing that, in return, is to look after these boys when they come home.
Excellent. Yeah, you brought up another interesting question. So while you were back in Canada, prior to and in the reserves, what was your perception of the RCAF's and then the RCAF reserves' relationship with the USAF?
We had very little to do with it, actually. I had more to do with them overseas, where we were, you know, mixing it up together quite a bit. Back here in Canada, we're pretty isolated from there. I think that NORAD itself was an excellent venue for an integration and for contact between them. And I think the Americans appreciated the fact that the Canadians were there on more than one occasion. Again, you know, military to military, I don't think there's ever been a problem between the USAF, let's say, and the RCAF. There's a lot of mutual respect. Even in our Sabre Pilots Association, you know, we have a lot of Americans flew Sabres in Korea, and they know all about it, and they exchange emails, and I mean, there's a lot of dialogue going on back and forth. It's on the political front that as we go along, that you can see perhaps a change of position depending on which administration is in the United States. You know, they weren't happy we didn't go to Iraq. We were right to not go to Iraq, for example. But at the time, it's pretty tense. Mm-hmm. We have a hardening of the border today. Yeah. That's fine. I mean, they're concerned. They've been attacked. And, you know, and they, obviously, it's, they still sell, you know, they still think about Pearl Harbor. That wasn't even on U.S. soil. So, it's, you know, politically, it's, there are differences. Militarily, I don't think, you know, I've never seen or felt any resentment or on one part or on the other. Certainly not at my level. In fact, there's been a lot of cooperation and admiration on both sides. So we send pilots down there to train. We have gunnery exercises down out of Florida, Top Gun and all that kind of stuff. And there's mutual, we have sort of a mutual admiration society. And they respect, everybody respects results. You know, if as we say, there's the target, put the bullet through the target. If you can do that, you're our man. So if you deliver, you're going to get respect. If you don't deliver, well, don't expect a pat in the back.
Excellent. Just to make sure I understand, any particular tensions that may have been going on between the Canada and the U.S. politically were no never mind to...
I never felt it at my level. Now, there are other levels that would be much more sensitive to that, at the general level. You know, at they're more, much more open to that. It would never show up at a squadron CO level or the pilot level.
Excellent.
If it was there, they shielded it very well.
I honestly think that's just about it.
Fantastic.
I don't think I have any more questions. I suppose, just because I like anecdotes, is there any one particular experience, either overseas or North America or both, that sticks out in your mind as kind of something you'll never forget? I know it's a broad, sweeping question, and feel free not to answer it.
No, not at all. It's just that it's kind of hard to remember. I tend to remember those things when we get together with all of the guys, when all the guys get together and they sort of trigger off memories. Things that you'll never forget, God knows, escape innovation. This is the training that they used to give you in France at those days, in case you were caught. They would have the French army out and tons of military. They would take about 50 or 100 pilots, drop them off somewhere, and say, your job is to turn around and get from there to there within this period of time. A little bit like Man Tracker that you see today. And everybody's looking for you with German Shepherds, and everything else. They take it real serious. It's an exercise for them, and it's an exercise for us. So that's quite memorable. But one advantage is that if you happen to grow up in the north in Canada, it gives you sort of a jump. But they had interrogation. They'd have the Brits come in, formal interrogations. And they give you the same sort of interrogation you can expect to receive if you were caught by the other side. and there were instances, for example, you talk about the Cold War. There were instances, we had one radio beacon that we used to use a lot. I think it was Fulda. Our navigation techniques in those days with a day fighter was not very good. It was called we had a little radio thing which would point, that needle would point to where the transmitter was, and then you'd fly on that. So you always tuned it into your base station, and then you would do a descent on this thing. We didn't have ILS and all of these more modern. We didn't have radar, and it was a day fighter.
Right.
And so what the boys on the other side would do, the USSR side, East Germans actually, they would turn around and put up a transmitter with the same frequency as yours, so that your thing honed in on them. So you had to be alert all the time, and with the same codes that would come in. And so if you weren't careful, you would fly across the border into East Germany, where you were a sitting duck and never know it. So, they used to play, there was a lot of games. The other game was if we threw four airplanes up, for example, to fly along the East German border, they would put up four, we put up another four, they put up another four, and eventually you'd have, anywhere from 16 to 30 aircraft on each side flying back and forth. You could see them.
Jeez.
And until somebody decided to, you start getting low on fuel and you go back. So these kind of little things going on all the time. But I think my most memorable one was the time that I was taking off on a scramble for an intercept, a practice intercept, because we would we had one base in Germany and one base, we call them our Zulu partners, and they would send them up and they would be the enemy, and then we would go up and we would be try to defend us, sort of thing. And we would do this once a day, and we would change roles, back and forth. So it was all to keep us practice. I was taking off one day, going through the cloud, and my engine just blew up. Well, it didn't quite blow up, but it was a hell of a bang, and then it started to shake so badly that you couldn't read the instrument panel. And so my wingman went out in front of me. We were in the cloud, so I was sort of half flying on him, and we got out of the above the cloud, broke in between layers, and they led me in to do a GCI approach. You have an option, you can bail out or you can try to bring it in. Well, you only got one engine, so, so there's no doubt which way you're heading down. And but I figured I had enough time, so GCI, which is our ground control intercept, our own radar, brought me around into a position descending down through the cloud and out, which lined me up with the runway. And I trusted them because they were guys that flew on the squadron. They knew what to expect, and they did that. They did a fantastic job. So I had only about maybe 30% power, not very much, and just broke out of cloud. The runway was right there, and all I had to do was plunk her down. So it was quite an experience. They took the back end off the aircraft after that, and there was not a single turbine blade left. It was all gone.
Oh, wow.
So it doesn't take much. It just takes one turbine blade sort of to come off, and then the thing starts to shake, rattle, and roll.
This is in the F-86?
Yeah. But you see, you got to be careful what you say, because what happened is that the CEO was waiting for me when I pulled off the end of the runway, and he says, "What do you think is wrong? What do you think happened?" And I said, "I think we threw a bucket, you know." "Oh, no, no," he says, "No, this engine doesn't lose turbine blades." I said, "Okay." So anyway, I get a call about 20 minutes later. "I want you to come over and have a look at this." So I went over to the other side into the hangar, maintenance hangar, and they had the back end off. There wasn't a blade left on it. He said, "You were right." He said, "You threw a bucket." So somehow, that made me an expert. Which is a very bad thing to happen. So they took me off the squadron, and they made me wing maintenance test pilot. Now, that is an awful job. It's an awful job because you know these guys, and you've known them for a good number of years. They go up to 40,000, 45,000 feet, and they get into an air fight, and they come down, and then they get something like a compressor stall because they were in some crazy attitude, you see, falling through the sky. And so he'd come home and come down. He says, "I got a compressor stall." "Oh," so they say, "Bob, why don't you go up and see if you can get a compressor stall in this aircraft?" I said, "Fine." What was he doing? "Well, I was up there in this thin air, and I had all the rudder on, and I was upside down." And I said, "Oh, my God. So you want me to go up and do that?" I said, "Listen, I know this guy. He's a really good pilot. If he says he got a compressor stall, he got a compressor stall." And so I spent a year doing these wonderful things of proving guys right. And the Orinda tech reps would say, "Oh, no, this doesn't happen. You go up and do it, get a compressor stall, declare an emergency, and do another landing." So the moral of the story is, don't be an expert. Be a generalist.
Perfect. Yeah, that last one was just some interest. Just the guy, like I said, I like anecdotes. So back to the. This concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Hewitt on 4 March 2011. And will you sign the
sure.
last one?
Sure. All right,
let's do that.
Cam, what's your family name?
McKeegan, M.C.
M little C?
Yep.
Yep.
K-E-I. G-A-N.
There we go. Today's 4 March, eh?
Yep. At least I hope so.
I'm the E, aren't I?
That's right.
Yeah, Ken, the other boys have got a much different perspective. As I said, I'm sort of driving the machine perspective, and not the it's not the political or the theoretical overview, and they certainly do. So that'll help a lot. So I'm sort of the guy on the flight line.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. You've given me some great stuff to work with here. So we have both signed the interview form, is that correct?
That's correct.
That is correct. Excellent. Well, thank you very much for doing this. it's much appreciated by me and UVic and Rusi and everyone who may benefit from this interview.
Fantastic. Well, I hope something comes out of it. I said that I feel a little short of knowledge, but on the other hand, and it's been a while, to say the least. In fact, now I'm trying to think of it, it's 50 years, I think.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, well, thank you.
And thank you. And I'll stop this now.